Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. Episode 229, Mishmishwe and the Red Dust, How War and Famine Led to British Rule in Lesotho. We are speeding up on the trek along history's trail. First, a word about the Boer-Basotho War of 1865-68. The 1850s and 1860s marked a period of profound demographic disruption for the Basotho, as the borders of Mishmishwe I's kingdom shifted repeatedly under pressure from colonial conflict and Boer expansion. Waves of refugees poured both in and out of the territory. By 1865, the population of what is now Lesotho was estimated at 180,000, which was a sharp increase from only 5 years earlier. Then drought and a three-year war against the Boers of the Free State had induced famine by 1868, and Mishmishwe I was running out of options as some of his people left the region. The war had created an immediate famine condition exacerbated by the drought, and this had a knock-on effect when it came to politics and human migration. After the territorial competition between the Basotho and their African neighbours subsided to some extent as the Basotho emerged as a nation, the struggle against the Boers of the Free State gained momentum. Growth in the economies of both the Free State and Basotho had produced an ongoing competition for land, and when drought struck, it stimulated violence. It's important to stress how the Free State economy had shifted from herding cattle to sheep, mainly as a result of Great Britain's demand for wool. The Boers regarded the English as an oppressive occupying regime, but that didn't stop farmers of the Free State making a buck off the empire when they could. This is reflected in trade data. In 1852, exports from the Orange River Sovereignty to Natal, the Cape, England, totaled £256,000 sterling, with wool making up £230,000 of that trade. In a census of 1856, Boers had 1.2 million sheep and goats and only 137,000 head of cattle. But the golden years of wool exports were over by the mid-1860s. The terrible droughts of 1860 and 61 were known as the Red Dust, when the Caledon River dried up for the only time in anyone's memory. When rains fell in 1863 and 4, it triggered massive plagues of locusts. This was not as disastrous as it sounds. While the pests gorged on wheat and mealies, the Basotho, like other Africans, gathered the insects in their tens of thousands. The heads and wings were removed, then they were dried, pounded into powder, mixed with water, and produced a hearty porridgey soup. This provided people with an excellent source of protein, and the Basotho also fed their cattle on dried locust. There are a host of reports from missionaries and visitors about how fat the Basotho cattle got eating dried locust feed. In the 21st century, scientists are once again formulating delicious recipes containing crickets and other creepy crawlies as the march to global food sustainability turns etymological. If you want the full background, I covered the outbreak of the Boer-Basotho War of 1865 in an earlier episode, along with the causes. The drought, scorched earth policy adopted by Free State President Johannes Brandt, left Mishmishwe with little choice. He could either surrender and be known as the Basotho King who gave away his people to the Boers, or he could ask the British to declare Basotho land a British protectorate. Some have said cynically that the British were entertaining this anyway, hungry for more land, and even more so after the discovery of diamonds. But that's tautological when it comes to Basotho land itself. The diamond discovery took place after Basotho land was folded into the British Empire. Still, we need to burrow into how this all worked out. The diplomacy and Wheeler dealing was extraordinary. By the end of 1867, the success of the Boer commandos in the raids into Basotho land had put an end to the prospect that the Free State burghers would voluntarily submit to the reimposition of British control. There had been a delicate little dance going on for more than 30 years where the Voortrekkers had made a beeline out of the Cape once the British took over, and the British had kept an eye on the Boers to ensure that they didn't grow too powerful and threaten their all-important strategic maritime route to the east. With the Boers succeeding in defeating most Basotho chiefs and Mishmishwe now facing an existential crisis, the opportunity arose for the British officials in the Cape to press for intervention once more. Sometimes be careful what you wish for. The Boers had wished to destroy Mishmishwe and were on the cusp of achieving their aims when their hopes were dashed. Apart from the reports of the destructive nature of Free State commando village raids, what had really caused a major uproar in England about the Free State action was their decision to evict all the French missionaries from Lesotho, as it was now being called. This inflamed evangelical opinion in Britain, and heaven only knows what happens when you do that. no pun intended, but plenty of hell to pay. Eugene Casali, the French missionary who spent so much time in Basutoland, sailed to England from France to urge the British government to intervene. This was not a lightweight ecclesiastical mission. Casali had established the mission station at Mugria at the foot of Mushweshwe's royal mountain Tabubusu in 1833. He translated the Gospel of Mark into Isisutu and was revered for his political advice to Mushweshwe. The Duke of Buckingham, who had succeeded Lord Carnarvon as colonial secretary in March 1867, was all ears. They say timing matters. And so it happened that Adderley, who was parliamentary under-secretary, was in favour of intervention, provided it could be managed without expense, i.e. without sending an army to fight the Boers. By June 1867, Adderley was writing that he should not object to Sir Philip Wodehouse's plan, the Cape Commissioner, to put Basutoland in a territory state for a time, but not one shilling should fall on the British taxpayer. More dispatches arrived from South Africa, full of news about Basutu dying of hunger and the increasingly violent methods being used by the Boers to flatten Mushweshwe's villages. In November, Buckingham persuaded his colleagues to authorise conditional intervention. On the 9th of December, Buckingham instructed Wodehouse to treat with Mushweshwe for the recognition of his people as British subjects. But there were a few loose ends that needed tying up. While Mushweshwe had already put out feelers to that end, it was the terms that were problematic. For a start, one of the conditions listed by Buckingham was that Basutoland be incorporated into Natal with the consent of the Natal legislature, thus without cost to Britain. A sleight of hand indeed, given the territory to the English in Natal, who were always going on about the empire. A second hitch was that the boundary between the Free State and Basutoland had to be agreed. Now, as you know, the Basutu and the Boers had been fighting for control of the Caledon Valley for decades. Philip Wodehouse was in a bit of a stew. What an onerous task. Although Wodehouse was fully in favour of bringing the Basutu under the protection of the British, he was fretting over whether they really were a united people with sufficient territory available for their survival. Mushweshwe was growing old. His power was draining away like sand in an hourglass. So it appeared unlikely this intervention would be successful. The Boers of the Free State were avaricious in their demands and in the ascendancy militarily. They weren't going to stop seizing Mushweshwe's land too quickly and be deprived of what they saw as a long-sought victory. Mushweshwe was an ageing king in anarchy, may ensue as he had lost control over most of his territorial chiefs. Natal, on the other hand, sought to control Basutoland as a sort of prestige moment, jolly old British Empire giving it to the uppity Boers and to carve up Mushweshwe's land for speculators. In the Cape, colonial politicians regarded any attempt at doing a deal with Mushweshwe as an excuse to make them pay for securing his territory. Colonials were quarrelling like mad in the representative parliament. Screeds of op-eds were being quilled by fuming egos, warning against involvement, while others had an opposite view. In London, Wodehouse's superiors were giving him the green light to go ahead and incorporate Basutoland into the empire without actually giving him the green back to do it. So it was within this miasma that Wodehouse wrote to Mushweshwe, President Brandt, and the new Natal Lieutenant Governor, Robert William Keat, that the British government had granted Mushweshwe's request that his people should become British subjects. The dispatch dated 13th January 1868. Mushweshwe sent his reply on the 26th of January. "I have become old," he said. "Therefore, I am glad that my people should have been allowed to rest and to lie under the large folds of the flag of England before I am no more." Mushweshwe said he didn't care which colony was going to annex Basutoland, Natal or the Cape, as long as his people were under protection of the British. What we have to remember is that Wodehouse was the High Commissioner of the Cape Colony, which had a representative but not a responsible government. There was a period of economic depression underway, and Wodehouse had been fighting a battle of wills against some of the colonists since he arrived. They regarded Basutoland as a hospital pass, more revenue and budget would go towards shoring up some black chief's fragile polity, while they preferred what you could call a Cape First policy. President Brandt pretty much ignored Wodehouse's missive. He brushed aside any suggestion of suspending hostilities because the Boers had the military advantage. He wrote back to Wodehouse in March 1868, believing the Free State were on the verge of crushing the last vestiges of Sutu resistance. One of the major sticking points anyway, at least according to the Boers, was based on revenge. They wanted Mushweshwe to force Chief Moretsane to hand over his followers who'd killed two Boers in 1867. Anyway, wrote Brandt, the Free State was already making arrangements for refugees. In a telling paragraph, he said, "The destitute can always find employment in the Orange Free State. Those who had taken refuge were contented and happy." Roadhouse had been intent on ensuring that Mashreshwe's people retained enough land to make any future annexation viable. They had to be able to feed themselves, so he was goading Mashreshwe to keep resisting Boer encroachments. Brandt's letter infuriated the British High Commissioner and goaded him into action. He hurriedly wrote a letter back to the Free State President, reminding him that it was only a few years earlier, under Sir George Grey's governorship, that they had intervened at the Boers' request to save the Free State Republic from the Basutu. Roadhouse further reminded Brandt that they had discussed a boundary in 1867, but Bloemfontein had rejected that line. The wretched and prolonged war had driven refugees into both Natal and the Cape Colony, and because the Boers were intent on pursuing an unfriendly policy, the High Commissioner was about to whip out his trump card. "I will peremptorily prohibit the passage of any further supplies of arms and ammunition to the Free State." On the 12th of March, 1868, he issued a proclamation declaring that Mashreshwe and his people were British subjects and his territory British territory. Talk is cheap, but British soldiers are musa expensive, Tagabal is saying, and Roadhouse was not mucking about. He immediately dispatched the entire frontier armed and mounted police, the FAMP, 500 strong, to Basutoland. It was commanded by Sir Walter Currie, and he moved fast, reaching Thabo Bisu only 14 days later on the 26th of March. Currie leapt off his horse to meet Mashreshwe and in a flourish read the annexation proclamation. "To the great joy of Mashesh and his tribe," he wrote in his report. The Basutu appeared to be holding their own. There were still many living inside the territory he thought had been lost to the Boers. Currie met the Free State commanders later, who agreed that they'd suspend aggressive operations for the moment, but they didn't withdraw back across the 1864 line. The Volksraad in Bloem rejected the new annexation, saying they already had an agreement, the Treaty of Thabo Bisu, which they had negotiated with Mashreshwe, and which Mashreshwe had since disowned. Roadhouse did his own leaping, in this case onto a ship, then a horse, and he rushed to Thabo Bisu himself. More rushing about, he arrived at Mashreshwe's HQ on the 15th of April, meeting the old king in the valley below Thabo Bisu. He was shocked at the state of the king, infirm, old, his hair white, his eyes greying with cataracts, his tall figure hunched over. His limbs had a scanty covering of flesh on them. Despite his weakness, Mashreshwe walked back up the mountain with Roadhouse and his emissaries. In an emotional discussion, inside a circle of councillors and principal men of Basutoland, he told everyone he had lived and seen enough. Then he asked his people to rely on the friendship of Governor Philip Roadhouse, and he had lost all power to assist them now. Despite earlier comments from Mashreshwe that he didn't mind which territory ruled him, when Roadhouse said that Basutoland would be incorporated into Natal, he objected, saying he'd prefer what he called a native reserve, where they alone would be allowed to dwell and dependent on the High Commissioner directly. Failing that, Mashreshwe said he'd prefer to become part of the Cape Colony rather than Natal. The reason was simple. Mashreshwe had a long and complex diplomatic relationship with the Cape. Natal was a bit of a mystery. And in an instant, Roadhouse was about to fling a curveball at Peter Maritzburg because he agreed with Mashreshwe. The reason this is so dramatic is that watching the whole interaction were both Keat, the Lieutenant Governor of Natal, and someone far more important to our story thus far, Sir Theophilus Shepston, the Natal Secretary for Native Affairs. What had taken place was a classic example of what happens in real-time situations where quick thinking and agile diplomacy and other high-wire tricksters pirouetting and pronking can twist a moment into a political gymnastic performance. Shepston and Keane were taken by surprise, to say the least. The two Natalians had arrived expecting to incorporate Basutoland into Natal with immediate effect, and Mashreshwe had agreed to this, along with all his chiefs. It is true, Mashreshwe and his councillors had said they thought it a good idea, but now it was apparent that this was merely to lure the British into the arrangement and were actually alarmed as the prospect became imminent. Into this jumble madness came a missive from the British government. They rapped Roadhouse over the knuckles for proclaiming the Basutu to be British subjects without first negotiating a boundary with the Free State and making sure that Natal was willing to incorporate Basutoland. What a mess! Roadhouse departed Thabo Bisu immediately, and took most of his frontier armed and mounted police force with him, leaving a token detachment under James Henry Bowker. Yes, the Bowker family once again intersects with our tale. Just a quick aside about James Henry. While he led mounted patrols, he also collected butterflies. The very epitome of colonial macho, outdoor, firing, muskets, tough, had a most interesting side chick, butterflies. His older sister was Mary Elizabeth Bowker, who we met last episode, the noted geologist. James Henry Bowker was a naturalist, collecting large numbers of butterflies, which he then supplied to museums. Bowker made many contributions to entomology, archaeology, and botany over his 40-year-long career, but his main interest was butterflies. He became an authority and the leading collector of Lepidoptera specimens of his time. He discovered 40 new species, and he gave the new genus Delanura immaculata, which have now sadly become extinct. He sent his butterfly discoveries to the South African Museum starting in 1860, and additional collections over the next 30 years, and continued even after he retired. He was involved in archaeological investigations from the period 1867 when he sent a collection of stone artifacts from East London to Joseph Hooker, the most renowned geologist of the period. He discovered ancient stone implements in the diamond diggings at Neil in the Western Cape and on the Vaal River and others near Maputo and Inhambane and in Zululand and Basutoland. Wending your way over the veld as a member of the FAMP left much time to wield a net catching butterflies and to chip away at rocks unearthing ancient South Africans, apparently. Wodehouse returned to Cape Town and composed quite a clever letter to Buckingham in the Colonial Office. What had happened, he surmised, was that everything had been sorted. Keat and Shepston were correct. They were supposed to take over Basutoland. But when they pitched up with a large AmaZulu force, 70 armed warriors, as bodyguards, well, the Basutu suddenly became nervous about the whole idea. Trusting that if they were successful in their main object, they may subsequently modify the details. Remarkably, this secret private letter did the job. It's also interesting to be privy to this kind of confidential backroom explanation. While on the surface it appeared that Moshoeshoe was flip-flopping on arrangements, Wodehouse painted a picture of the Basutu king wielding diplomatic clout. Colonial Secretary Buckingham accepted the explanations, promising full support as long as there was no cost to the empire for whatever outcome prevailed, and that outcome was still indeterminate. The next remarkable moment was when the Free State Government delegation sailed into port in England to urge the British government to disavow annexation and repudiate Wodehouse. Buckingham met with the delegates but told them that the annexation was going ahead and that the Free State should settle their boundary ASAP. Things were indeed going to move fast. The Free State delegates sailed back to South Africa and crucial negotiations took place at Aliwal North in February 1869. At about the time that news of the great second diamond discovery, or was it the third, no matter, was washing around the globe. Wodehouse led the British delegation. The Free State sent a small group of commissioners. Incredibly, no Basutu delegation was present. It was the British negotiating Basutu territory with the Boers. By the 12th of February, they had managed to reach an agreement, subject to ratification by the two governments. Henceforth, Basutoland's western boundary would run from the northern Caledon at Yamabach Drift southeast to the junction of the Orange and the Makahleng River. The northern boundary would be from the Caledon turning east to the Putiatsana River. This was east of Marapo's territory, which had been annexed by the Free State in 1866. Soon Marapo would make a written request to be released from this annexation agreement, and the northern boundary extended further east to the source of the Caledon, pretty much where it is today. At first glance, the Basutu didn't do too badly. They'd gained a considerable block of arable land to the west, including 80 kilometres of riverfront on the right bank of the Caledon. But compared to what they'd claimed a generation earlier, they came off extremely badly. All the land north of the Caledon, the land they'd fought Mzilikazi for, was lost. Most of the area between the Caledon and Orange, which they also claimed, was also lost. They'd retained ground the ancestors had secured before the Lifukani, but much less than the territory that Governor Napier had recognised back in 1847. Wodehouse now had to relay the news to the Basutu. On the 22nd of February, he addressed a major Pitsu gathering at Korokoro, just south of Tabo Basu. Watching was Bowker, who'd been waiting there for 10 months, collecting butterflies and insects in his spare time. More importantly, there were 3,000 Basutu men present, and all the chiefs, including Retzi, Morapo, Masopa, Those were Meshweshwe's surviving sons of his first wife. Then Sikonyela, Tlali, Tsikelu, his junior sons were also there. Moratsani, the Taung chief, and 8 missionaries. Absent was the king, Meshweshwe. Old age and infirmity had left him virtually bedridden, and he could no longer descend from his lofty Dabubusu fortress. Of all present, only Moratsani contested the boundary announcement, naturally so because most of his territory lay on the other side of the Caledon River. The British moved Moratsani to western Basutoland land between the Caledon and Orange. The other chiefs were acutely aware of this loss of land, but they all knew that the Boers were close to destroying them all. At least some of their independence had been retained. They'd also seen their people recover. By this time, the harvest was also recovering. Livestock was fattening up. The terrible drought was over. Like other times in South African history, the weather and landscape had served up a reason not to continue fighting until there are no scraps. Sometimes we must take defeat and live with an eye on the future. It is said that when Wodehouse climbed up to the lofty fortress where Meshweshwe waited, wizened and decrepit, and explained the boundary, Meshweshwe replied sarcastically, "Is that peace?" One person who thought not was lawyer David Dale Buchanan, pioneer editor of the Witness newspaper in Pietermaritzburg. He had visited Dabubusu in 1867, and he believed the boundary negotiations were a deliberate attempt by the British and the Boers, working in cahoots to deny the Basutu their land. He joined forces with French missionary François Dumont and launched a campaign which was going to delay everything. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platforms. That helps elevate its visibility. And you can head off to desmondlatham.blog where I'll load an update about various episodes. You can also email me from there. Until next, Sameya Huntley.